It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Picture a large urban university, a spread out campus, many programs, academic and research, large student body and workforce. How do you bring sustainability to an entire university? Aurora Sherard joined the University of Pittsburgh a little more than 6 months ago as its first director of sustainability. Prior to that, she'd been the executive director of the Green Building Alliance. Aurora Sherard, welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
So, Aurora, the university had already been engaged in sustainability initiatives when you assumed your post. So what were Pitt officials looking for? What was the directive given to you?
The directive was the entire Pitt Sustainability Plan, which was adopted in January 2018. It has 61 goals across 15 impact areas, and they basically said, go after this. Help sustainability happen across the university, across departments, schools, with students, faculty, and staff in a way that it hasn't been able to prior.
You said 61 goals?
61 goals, yes.
Did you at least get a chance to prioritize, or did they tell you the priority?
Nope. The University Sustainability Committee scoped the Pitt Sustainability Plan in the way that the university community thought that it needed to come to fruition.
Does the definition of sustainability differ from organization to organization, from business to business, and even from the Green Building Alliance to the University of Pittsburgh?
In general, the definition of sustainability is the same across organizations, but people prioritize things in different ways. So at the University of Pittsburgh, we actually worked with the University Sustainability Committee to create the University of Pittsburgh sustainability definition.
And it is?
It is balancing equity, environment, and economics so that current and future generations can thrive.
You've got those three E's in there.
Yep, you've got those three E's. That's what sustainability is. It's the balance.
So I want to ask you, Pitt is an historic campus full of notoriously old, maybe drafty buildings. How big of a challenge was it to create a plan around a campus that was never designed, let's face it, originally to be energy efficient?
Well, that's no different than most other buildings across Pittsburgh, the Northeast, and even the United States. And so the university had long been a partner with Green Building Alliance in the 2030 Challenge. Pitt Facilities has long been working on renovations of buildings and really looking at energy efficiency, water efficiency of those structures, and really bringing them up to function for students, staff, and faculty on campus, as well as keeping an eye on what the costs of those are to run on a regular basis.
You mentioned the 2030 district. You played a major role in creating that district when you were with the Green Building Alliance. For those not quite sure, they've heard that term. What is the 2030 district?
So the Pittsburgh 2030 district is one of 19 such districts around North America. It's facilitated in Pittsburgh by Green Building Alliance, which is a local nonprofit that's been around for 25 years. And it has over 100 property partners who own over 500 buildings. All of those buildings are committed to 50% reductions in energy use, water use, and transportation emissions below baselines by the year 2030.
Okay. And how big is that district?
Over 500 buildings. It includes downtown, uptown, Oakland, and in Pittsburgh.
All right. So it's got a sizable footprint.
Yeah, just a few. Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned the sustainability plan. 61 goals. Do they touch all aspects of the university, from emissions to energy use to water use?
They certainly do. So there are big overarching goals like reducing greenhouse gas emissions 50% below 2008 by the year 2030. And then they touch topics such as mental health, collaborations between faculty, industry, and nonprofits. They also go into food security of students, staff, and faculty, into reusable to-go containers. I mean, you name it. It's in there.
I want to touch upon some of those goals. One of those goals, actually, you took a major step toward very recently by announcing a plan to use hydroelectricity for more than a quarter of energy use through a deal with a Boston-based firm. A hydro plant is going to be constructed on the Allegheny River.
Yes, it will be the first in the Pittsburgh region in over three decades. It will be owned by Rye. The University of Pittsburgh will buy 100% of the electricity produced by the low-impact facility to be built at the existing Allegheny Lock and Dam Number 2, which is at the Highland Park Bridge.
So the permits or whatever were in were available for quite some time, but nobody actually built it? What?
Right. So these permits have existed and are held by RYE. They own the permits from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They own 8 permits for existing for facilities like this one on the Three Rivers.
All right. So when I think of hydroelectric, I think of a big dam, this big, massive flowing of water. And yet this is on a river.
Yeah, so this is actually a low-impact hydro facility. Another name for it is run-of-the-river. So you just build a facility with turbines almost underwater. There's like 1 or 2 stories above water. And then the river just flows through it, and you produce energy from that river flowing.
Well, you said RYE has owned the permits. Mm-hmm. Were they just looking for a customer to make it worthwhile to actually build the thing?
Correct, and they're looking for customers for the other 7. And we're hoping that our commitment will actually help others look at these facilities a little bit differently.
And what's the time frame for this hydroelectric power plant?
It will open in late 2022.
Very good. All right, so let's move on to some of the other goals, if we might. Are they the goals you mentioned, you alluded to 61, are they all tied to the 2030 district? Were they sort of adapted as part, you know, say, oh, these goals were set up by the 2030 district, we can apply them here and then maybe do some specifics for the university itself?
Right. So there are 3 very specific goals that are tied to the 2030 district, those reductions in energy, water, and transportation emissions. We adopted those as a university whole hog back in 2014. Those got wrapped into the Pitt Sustainability Plan, and then a whole host of other goals got lumped in together with those, including goals to reduce lawn area 15% by 2030, I think it is, to increase tree canopy 50%, to create resource net for students to make sure that they are financially, physically, and mentally well. You name it, it's probably in there in some way.
So the tree canopy absorbing some CO2, but also some shade and cooling things off.
Yeah. And, you know, there's studies that show that when people are outside, have connections with nature, that they actually feel better, test better, you know, are better people.
Oh, test better. Sounds like it's directed to students, among others.
Among others, yeah.
Okay. So reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 50%, also reducing water use. What do you feel are the most challenging of those goals?
I mean, there are a lot of challenging goals. Some of the more challenging ones are the ones that aren't necessarily as quantifiable and measurable with a certain reduction or growth over time. There are goals that are pretty general, like identify and improve the environmental quality of our indoor and outdoor spaces. Mm-hmm. That's broad. How do we do that? How do we do that inside? How do we do that outside? How can we hold these other goals into there? There's also embrace a culture of impactful service through long-term investment in our communities. The University of Pittsburgh already does this in some ways. How can we make sustainability a part of that? We ask those questions with every goal.
Mm-hmm. What about reducing emissions when it comes to transportation? I mean, the campus is fairly spread out.
I would say compared to some campuses around the country, it's definitely not spread out. So Oakland is the 3rd largest downtown area in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. There are just over 70,000 people who go to work in Oakland every day. So we are part of a larger network at Pitt. And transportation emissions reduction is a big part of that. It's not just getting people out of single occupancy vehicles and walking, biking, taking transit, but it's also looking at fuel switching and what our opportunities are there in the future.
Right. Is it emissions and transportation sort of on campus property itself, but or is it also involving, you know, employees who are driving or who are commuting to work on the campus?
Yeah, it's both. It's both commuters and vehicles that the university owns.
Right. You were talking a little bit earlier about the hydroelectric power plant. One of the goals has to do with produce or procure at least 50% of electric energy from renewables. All right, so that's procuring because you're buying the energy. Is there any movement toward actually producing your own?
So there are 2 small solar installations that Pitt owns so far. One is on Benedum Hall, which is the School of Engineering. Mm-hmm. That's a research installation right now. And then there's also an installation at the University of Pittsburgh at Bradford campus. And we're currently looking at what our future on-campus renewable generation opportunities are. So stay tuned.
Are there roadmaps, in a sense, to achieve the goals in this sustainability plan? Or do you have to sort of devise the ways that you're going to get there?
For some of them, there are roadmaps, depending on who the primary internal champion and sort of owner of that goal is. And some of those, we're developing those roadmaps. For instance, water is a challenge in the region, and it's a challenge for the University of Pittsburgh as well. So we're in the process of creating a one water strategy for campus and trying to figure out what does that mean for us to handle our sanitary water, storm water, potable water, water reuse all in one place, and how can we be a model for the region as we do that.
So you're the director of sustainability. You have the people who have helped create the goals, the committee. What about buy-in from students and employees? How much of that? Is it a hard sell?
I think if you had said, is it a hard sell in 2003, 2008, 2012, it was a harder sell at that time. But Pitt has been working on sustainability activities for over 15 years. We don't necessarily talk about it loudly and often, but we're doing that a lot more. And there's a lot of buy-in across departments, across students, staff, and faculty. And we're really trying to activate everybody on campus and get them involved and part of the conversation in a way that they're able and interested. And so we can be creative about what our solutions are.
All right, about a minute left. So I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, you came to Pitt from the Green Building Alliance. That word alliance, how much of this new role for you is about building alliances, not only on campus, but within the region to help you meet those 61 goals?
Yeah, so sustainability, wherever you are, it's all about alliances. It's about getting to know the people internal to your organization, what their priorities are, how they would like to work together to advance existing goals and craft future goals. And then, you know, no organization exists in an ivory tower. And so we really have to get off campus and work with local governments, nonprofits, corporations, and individuals to advance the goals that we have as a region. And as a planet, to really get where we need to be in terms of true sustainability.
In a sentence or two, what do you need to reach those 61 goals by 2030?
A lot of people to do a lot more with every decision they make.
Aurora Sherrard is the University of Pittsburgh's first Director of Sustainability. Thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with that plan.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin, and you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Just ahead on The Confluence, a Pittsburgh-based group is offering specialized self-defense training for those who experience the threat of gender-based violence. 50 years ago, millions of tons of sewage, blood from slaughterhouses, oil from refineries, and toxic waste from chemical companies free-flowed into Pennsylvania's rivers. Coming up, hear how the Clean Water Act helps save one waterway on the eastern side of the Commonwealth. And one Pittsburgh-area professor has created a new method for teaching evolution to youngsters. Vaughn Cooper is live in studio. That's when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
War may be hell, but it certainly makes for a compelling song. Metallica released the video for their epic anti-war song, One, 30 years ago today, telling the story of a World War I soldier begging God to take his life after being hit by a landmine. One was the first top 40 hit for Metallica. The tension, angst, and aggression of Metallica's composition helped to tell the story as the music builds from gentle and melodic to a burst of speed metal reminiscent of rapid machine gun fire. One was the first Metallica song to get a video, and it features scenes from the 1971 film Johnny Got His Gun. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories. A weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today we hear from Setpoint, a Pittsburgh-based group offering specialized self-defense training for those who experience the threat of gender-based violence. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook has more on the organization that serves groups both nationwide and here at home.
Kick!
No!
Elbow!
No!
Palm!
No!
Good.
The set part is strength and empowerment training. And the point is the point at which we believe in our strengths and we defend what we value.
Lisa Nakamura is Setpoint's founding director and also a 6-degree senior master in Shaolin Kung Fu. She says by targeting set point service to communities most at risk of suffering sexual, physical, and mental trauma, the organization aims to prevent potential violence from happening.
Communities of color, communities of immigrant families, people within the Islamic faith. We're working a lot with the LGBTQ community. We're also supporting survivors of previous sexual violence and domestic assault, as well as working with persons in recovery.
When we founded SetPoint, one of the things that was really, really important to us is that this training be accessible.
Executive Director Michelle Montag is a third-degree black belt in Shaolin Kung Fu. Both she and Nakamura are also trained in sexual harassment and rape prevention. Montag says the vision involves participants developing the skills vital for all aspects of self-preservation.
This type of self-defense training shows that people that go through it come out with greater levels of confidence. And a lot of that is really the coupling of the physical skills with skills around situational awareness and skills around boundary setting and using your voice.
Montag says the statistics of assault against women are shocking.
About 1 in 3 women worldwide is the victim of a domestic violence. We know that colleges and universities all across the country now that say somewhere between 20% and 25% of young women in colleges are sexually assaulted during their 4 years. It is something that cuts across social classes, it cuts across genders, it cuts across races, it cuts across ethnicities, religions.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Molly Pascal is an active participant in SetPoint's ongoing sessions and says she has greatly benefited from the programming.
It's intimidating to walk into a workshop like this, and there's a degree of fear.
Speaking from her own experiences, she also speaks on behalf of many women who are overcoming the stereotype that women are unable to protect themselves.
I don't think I even knew how to throw a punch when I walked into this workshop. I learned, you know, where to put my thumbs on a fist. I learned how to hold my hand. There are so many things a woman can do to go for the eyes or the throat or the instep in the foot. And it doesn't take necessarily a lot of physical strength to do those things.
So far, over 1,500 women and men have participated in SetPoint's ongoing training and sexual assault counseling sessions. I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. These days, the area between Philadelphia and New York, hugging the Delaware River, is lively and life-giving. It offers drinking water to millions of people, a habitat for wildlife, and concerts and festivals flourish along the banks. But for much of the 20th century, parts of the Delaware were a literal dead zone due to toxic waste from industry. WHYY's Dana Bate reports.
It's 9:30 on a Tuesday morning, and Joe Newton is taking his 20-foot motorboat onto the Delaware River from the Neshaminy State Marina in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. He comes to the river to fish, sometimes as often as 4 times a week. But when he first moved to the area in 1975, he couldn't fish here.
I'm originally from North Jersey, and I grew up fishing the northern Delaware, which is basically pristine water. You can eat the fish, the water's clear. When I came down here, you wouldn't dare eat the fish. And the water had about maybe 3 foot visibility and a lot of debris.
It didn't smell good and it didn't look good.
That's Newton's buddy, Ron Soto. Soto's grandfather was a tugboat captain on the Delaware through the 1950s. As a young boy, Soto would sometimes ride with him.
I said, how's the fishing here in the river when I'd be on this tugboat? And he'd say, there's no fish. I said, why not? He said, well, there's an oxygen barrier in the water and there's no oxygen here. Consequently, the fish can't live.
What Soto was referring to is something called dissolved oxygen, DO for short. Fish breathe oxygen just like people do, Only their oxygen is dissolved in water. Fish generally need about 5 parts per million to thrive. But in 1964, DO levels were nearly zero in parts of the river around Philadelphia. The reason? Poop.
Back in the 50s and 60s, we were just dumping all of our sewage right into the river. And that goes back to really to colonial times.
That's Danielle Krieger, a scientist with the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary. Standing by a pier on the Delaware, she explains that sewage breeds bacteria in the water, and that bacteria eats up all the oxygen. By 1964, about 1 million pounds of waste was going into the river every day. More than 60% of that came from sewage treatment plants, with cities like Philadelphia, Camden, and Wilmington contributing the most. But it wasn't just sewage. There was blood from slaughterhouses, oil from refineries, and toxic waste from chemical companies. Almost none of the waste was disinfected, so it contained high levels of bacteria, again, eating up all of the oxygen. Richard Pepino was studying biology in the 1960s. Standing by Penn's Landing today, he remembers his college professor sending his class onto the Delaware to measure the oxygen levels.
We were getting no readings. And so they said, somebody's got to tell a professor the machine's broken. I said, well, I'm not going to tell him. The machine wasn't broken. There was no oxygen. How can you support an ecosystem where the amount of oxygen was too low to measure?
The answer was, you couldn't. The dead zone on the river ran from Philadelphia to about 25 miles downriver in Marcus Hook. That made it impossible for migratory fish like shad to breed. They would die on their journey upstream before they could lay their eggs in the upper Delaware. Once plentiful caviar and sturgeon also disappeared. That spelled the death of a regional industry once worth hundreds of millions of dollars. But even for people who didn't fish, Pepino says the river just wasn't a place people wanted to be.
You look out on the river today, it looks appealing. It did not look appealing in those days.
The decomposing bacteria gave off noxious hydrogen sulfide fumes. Some shipping vessels refused to dock in Philadelphia because it smelled so bad. A World War II Army pilot claimed he could smell the river from 5,000 feet in the sky, and the fumes would react with the lead paint on ship hulls and turn them black. Various clean water campaigns gained support but then sputtered out. Cleaning up the river was going to be expensive, and the country's money had been tied up in World War II. But then something started happening.
The people were fed up.
Pepino says in the 1960s, a large populist movement was afoot. And even people who didn't think of themselves as activists started pushing to clean up the river.
People just didn't want dirty air and dirty water. My mom we lived in West Philadelphia. She used to hang out her sheets. And when she went to pick them up at the end of the day, she was ticked off because they had soot on them. And my mother and my father were not really environmental activists, but they wanted the environment clean.
Then, in 1969, something unbelievable happened.
A river caught fire.
The highly industrial and polluted Cuyahoga River in Cleveland, Ohio, caught fire after sparks from a passing train lit oil-slicked debris ablaze.
One could hardly imagine a scenario when a river caught fire. And many people think that was the turning event that forced the Congress to take very serious action with both the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act.
In 1972, Congress passed the Clean Water Act with broad bipartisan support. President Richard Nixon vetoed the bill, but within a day, Congress overturned the veto and the bill became law. The newly minted Environmental Protection Agency was responsible for enforcing the law, and Pepino got a job there after grad school. The law made it illegal to dump any pollutant into waterways without a permit from the EPA and set wastewater standards for industry. It also offered up money to cities and states to upgrade their sewage treatment plants. As an avid fisherman, Joe Newton says even a decade in, he could see a change.
By 80, 82, there was a huge difference, absolute huge difference.
The water started looking cleaner, and the fish slowly started to return. Shad, herring, all sorts of bass. These days, you can catch striped bass that are nearly 40 pounds.
In this river, that's amazing. In the ocean, common, but not out here. We had the best shad run I think I've ever seen this past season.
on the Delaware River.
But the law wasn't an overnight success. It took decades of work, more than $1 trillion, and lots of trial and error before the Clean Water Act lived up to its name. Dana Bate, WHYY News.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Teachers are always looking for more effective ways to get students involved, get them excited to learn. The STEM phenomenon, science, technology, engineering, and math, has been used successfully to engage students. But what about when it comes to teaching evolution? Dr. Vaughn Cooper is an evolutionary biologist, director of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Evolutionary Biology and Medicine, and he's the founder of an evolving STEM program. That program has been implemented in 10 schools across three states, several of them in our region, including Pittsburgh Science and Technology Academy, SciTech, a magnet school in the Pittsburgh Public School District. Vaughn Cooper joins us in studio along with Edwina Kinchington, who has taught biology at SciTech since 2009, and two of her students, both in 11th grade, Mia Perez and Sachin Thiagarajan. Welcome to you all. Good to have you here on The Confluence.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Vaughn, I'm going to start with you. How did you see evolution being taught before you created this program? Why did you want to shake the system up?
So, I mean, the truth is that we typically learn evolution through history, right? It's a historical science. And so I was a history major and I enjoyed it. But the reality is that a lot of people tend to glaze over when we have a historical lesson. And Darwin's finches are terrific. It's a wonderful story, but it's not the kind of engaging material that gets people excited about thinking about how evolution works. So I was really fortunate when I was a PhD student to see evolution in action by doing experiments with microbes. And once I saw that, an actual change in real time, I knew that had to be the way for students to learn evolution going forward.
So what makes your program special?
What makes it special is that that they do authentic experiments with bacterial populations in which students learn evolution by seeing it in real time, essentially, over the course of a week. And so what's special is that it's fast, it's hands-on, and it promotes a lot of inquiry for students to ask questions about how it works.
All right. Edwina, I understand that you adopted this program and you started it in your fall semester. Is that correct?
That's correct. We implemented it in our cellular signaling class with our students, both from an evolutionary standpoint, but also the way the evolution happens is through cell signaling.
Cell signaling. Help us out here.
So the bacteria form these biofilms, and these biofilms happen because the microbes, the bacteria, signal to each other, and there are different proteins that are expressed on the surface of the cells that, from a signaling standpoint, I was interested in to share with my students. Mm-hmm. So that's how we first implemented it.
I mentioned biology teacher. Have you been teaching evolution in the past, and why did you want to make a switch?
So I teach what's called the body and behavior concentration at our school, which is not your traditional ninth grade biology class. It's a two-year program for 10th and 11th graders. And yes, we touch on evolution, but never quite in this way, never so much as a hands-on laboratory approach. And it was very engaging for the students.
All right. I want to ask Mia and Sachin, had you learned much about evolution prior to 11th grade in your studies? If so, what was it like? Mia?
We were mostly taught about Darwin's finches. When Dr. Vaughn mentioned it, it brought some back. I just remember the pictures. That's all.
And Sachin,
yeah,
what do you remember about
it? The most evolution that we learned was usually out of a textbook. There would be pictures, like Dr. Vaughn said. There would be Darwin's finches that would just show the different evolutionary capabilities of each finch depending on what type of food they ate. But that's really, we only scratched the surface of evolution. So this is much more in-depth for students like us because it gives us the hands-on experience to understand what evolution is.
Well, was it interesting what you learned? Did it maybe sort of cause more questions than the answers you got?
Yes, I think we got to really just figure out what was going to end up happening. Like, we weren't given what we were supposed to see in the end, so we had to figure it out ourselves. And I think, like, I want to learn more about it and do my senior project on it, because I've never really learned that much about evolution, and just being taught this much made me more curious about it.
I'm going to get to all of you in this question. It has to happen in what is happening in the lab. Vaughn, let's start with you about what you intend to happen in the lab, and then Edwina, what you want the students to learn from it, and then what you grasp from it. Okay, so Vaughn.
Yeah, so the students all start out with a clone, the same version of this bacteria called Pseudomonas fluorescens. It's a probiotic bacteria that actually helps plants grow by suppressing fungal disease, but it's safe, so they can, you know, that's good for high schools. And they inoculate or add it to some growth media, and the culture grows up, and only the cells that stick to a plastic bead that's in the tube make it to the next round, and that generates natural selection for the best bacteria, to the best stickers. And then they continue that process.
I'd want to pick it up from there. What?
So one of the goals in science teaching today is to get students to ask their own research questions. And this curriculum enables students to do that. So they follow the protocols and have an idea of what they're doing. But with the data, they develop their own research question, which each group can ask and then collect data to help answer that, and then finally present that data. And this curriculum was superb in that approach.
All right. So, Sachin and Mia, so what are some of the questions you wanted to know that maybe what you found out triggered even more questions? Go ahead, Sachin.
Well, one of the questions that I asked was whether there was actually an increase in biofilm production as the bacteria continued to evolve. And the way that we found that out was by running it through something called a spectrometer, and then it would check the absorbance rates of that bacteria, and depending on that, the higher the absorbance rate, the more biofilm was produced. So it was interesting because not everybody had the same question, so everybody had different data, everybody had different outcomes with that data. So it was very interesting seeing what other people did as well.
Mia?
The way my group looked at which bacteria was better at growing a biofilm was on the plating. Like, we looked at which colony continued to grow when we replated them over and over again. So, yeah, I guess everybody did it a different way.
And Vaughn, what is important about the growing of the film?
Yeah, so there's really strong selection for them to stick and produce this film. And it turns out that when bacteria form biofilms, there's many ways for them to do it. And so this actually allows for multiple mutants to contend and rise to high frequency. And sort of the neat trick is that when you plate them on growth auger, so you can visualize these colonies, they look different. They look like rosettes or little wrinkly variants. They look conspicuously different from where you started. And so the evolutionary outcome is sort of obvious.
And does that excite you as a teacher when your students are asking questions?
Yeah, it's the most exciting thing as a teacher, and I had a great deal of fun during this module, and mostly seeing the students engaged when they saw how the phenotype of the bacterial colony changed, when they developed their own questions, what they were interested in doing. It is the most satisfying and engaging as a teacher as well.
Yvonne, I want to get back to you in the sense that asking questions, is it almost as exciting as getting the answers? You know, having students, young students, being curious.
I mean, it's captivating. I feel like almost like a grandparent on Christmas Day. The reason I say grandparent is that I get to go in and sort of inject a little bit of excitement with these experiments, and then Edwina is the proper parent who has to help clean up the mess and also help assess their learning. But I mean, I think our goal obviously is that they learn the content a heck of a lot better.
So Sachin and Mia, did you sort of feel responsible for the bacteria, if you would?
Yes, it was very exciting because usually Dr. K, like, is always on our backs about safe lab practice, and we really had to just be careful on our own. There was one lab group that dropped their bead, so uh-oh, it picked up a bunch of bacteria that didn't belong on it and really messed up their project, so you had to be really responsible.
Mm-hmm. Sachin?
Yeah, basically everything Mia said. You have to have safe laboratory practice, especially for an experiment that's as clean, as septic as required as this one. There's a lot of bacteria in the outside world, and if you're not careful, it could easily pick up on that, and then when you're plating it, those results could get messed up.
Yeah. Vaughn, you used the analogy of a grandparent, if you would, on Christmas Day. Do you ever go back into the classrooms? Are you in the classrooms? Are you in Winnis' classroom and sort of, I'll say eavesdropping to just sort of get the reactions of the students as they engage in this process?
Yeah, so I try and visit every school at least once during the curriculum. And the best part is actually the eavesdropping, as you say, just sort of wandering around and listening to the students come up with their own questions, talk to one another about what they find interesting, what they don't like about it. You know, the bacterial cultures don't smell the best, and I hear that a lot. But then they ask these questions about why is this different, and Dr. Cooper, and what could I do next, and could I design a different experiment? And that's the magic.
Edwin, I think we started with you started this in the fall semester, and now you're about to start it with sophomores, with 10th graders. Why so?
So in our curriculum, we have a microbiology course for our first year 10th grade students, and this will be a perfect adaptation for evolution. The students will learn and have learned to grow bacteria, identify the colonies, and then similarly ask their own questions, just as the 11th graders did. And the other really exciting thing as a teacher is to hear a student like Mia, who said she really wants to now learn more about it and potentially for her senior project.
Mm-hmm. And we have just a few minutes left. Mia and Sachin, I wanted to ask you, because now it's being introduced to 10th graders, so do you have any advice? Maybe you have siblings, maybe you have younger friends who are about to start this. Any advice for them who are about to start this in the 10th grade? Mia?
Just play coat. Pay close attention and follow every step. Very detailed.
And don't drop it. Right?
Yeah, don't drop it.
Sachin?
Yeah, make sure that you're very careful with whatever you're doing, or you'll get a result that you don't expect. And that's not always a bad thing.
It's not always a bad thing? Did you get a result you didn't expect?
No, I got a result I expected, but if I did, I would be very surprised.
Okay. Edwin, I want to ask you your advice, too. So maybe teachers in other schools, in other school districts, say, how's that work? Does it really engage the kids? I mean, what's your advice, and does it have to sort of percolate up from the teacher level up to the principal, the people who decide? I know you have an important role in the deciding of the curriculum, but for others who maybe not, they have to make that, you know, convincing argument.
Sometimes as a teacher, it can be fearful to take on new things that you haven't done before, especially lab work, which is a lot of work and prep and cleanup. But Dr. Cooper does have assistant Dr. Metella, who helped us, and that was essential. Don't be afraid, I would tell other teachers, to do this experience, because the payback will be enormous. And I do believe that more and more teachers are having more say over what type of curriculum they can use.
And what have you learned that maybe you will adapt your approach to this maybe in the next academic year?
So just making sure that the outcomes and the presentation, the final kind of regrouping, is always very important. You know, what did we learn from this? Sharing out from the students.
And Vaughn, a final question to you. Do you expect your program to be adopted by other schools? I understand there's a new grant in the works to expand the program a little farther.
Right. So we have a couple of proposals pending and a new grant in hand, which has allowed this program to be launched in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, led by a colleague and their students. It was also, by all accounts, really successful. There, they really focused on the link of this program to our understanding of the global problem of antimicrobial resistant infections, and I think that's really exciting. So I think our plan is to try and get this ultimately into hundreds of schools in the coming years, and it's through terrific partnerships with SciTech that's going to make it happen. I mean, Dr. K, as her students call her, is a terrific leader for the region and in facilitating other teachers to adopt this program.
Well, thank you very much, and good luck to you with the program. Mia Perez and Sachin Thiagarajan are juniors at Pittsburgh Science and Technology Academy. Edwina Kitchington is a biology teacher at SciTech, And Vaughn Cooper is the director of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Evolutionary Biology and Medicine and the founder of the Evolving STEM program. Thanks so much to all of you for being here today.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, we'll stay in the classroom. Siobhan Vivian and Rachel Lippincott started as teacher and student, but today they're colleagues and both best-selling authors. How a show-out performance in school led to a blockbuster writing assignment. Plus, Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey offers his two cents on the government shutdown, tariffs, and the ongoing investigation into the Trump administration's relationship with Russia. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair. Plus, Bix Donnelly, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.